Okay, so we could begin the afternoon session. we'll do it similar as yesterday. Open it up for questions. If anybody has any questions, I'll see if I can come up with any answers. Yes.
Aware that in Canada now, medically assistance in death is legal. And so it raises the question for me, it's legal for people who are terminally ill and under certain conditions. As an old person who, you know, will be sick and dying not too far off, it raises the question of, if I got to a point where I felt even with good palliative care and hospice care, I couldn't withstand the pain any longer.
Mm-hmm.
It's an option. But of course it raises the question for me of the first precept.
Right.
Not taking the life.
Yeah, it's pretty clear.
So it wouldn't be an option.
Well, I think also, you know, one of the things is as soon as you open options up to the mind, then the nature of the mind is then to look for the logic and the reasons for it. The there is a and as we were talking about yesterday, there isn't necessarily some inherent value in being miserable and suffering. But I think there is an inherent value in cherishing life or respecting life, not to the point of desperately clinging to it, but to be able to be present for the process of sickness and dying, so that there is a natural letting go of the identification with the physical form and the personality that has been constructed around that, and that process of dissolution of the body is a really important part that helps one to take that in. And particularly these days, I mean, there's very good hospice care, very good pain management strategies, so that it isn't as if one has to go in to that with some gung-ho idealism don't want to take any kind of medicine or just do this naturally. Well, it's not that's not so helpful, but the being present for that, to really be present for that, that basically the falling apart of the body is opens doorways to release that are that don't really happen with God, I just want to be done with this. This totally sucks. You know, that kind of aversion and fear are what keep us bound to this cycle and identification. So that's actually, there are discourses where the Buddha points to, you know, sometimes the actual penetration, I mean, sometimes of course people experience awakening say in their practice, in their training, but there's also that transition to death and letting go of the body is a really important transition for relinquishing that identification, because it, especially when you're just, yeah, the dying process is not, you can't deny it anymore. Then you can put that burden down, and so that you know, I think it's you know, I think that's tends to be bypassed by a yeah, having that option, and so much of that option is either fear of pain, fear of the having, not being what one thought one was, either independent, strong, alive. so then, but that underlying, yeah, desire or that underlying aversion and fear is not wholesome conditioning for the mind to so. You know, that precept is, I mean, it's not just a blind holding to some kind of rule that's established. There, you know, there's layers of profundity that we need to explore, and then the non-harming, not taking of life, you know, applies to ourselves. Yeah.
Following on that question.
Yeah. It looked like it was a following on that question.
I know Dan quite well.
Right.
But it does lead to the questions about the fifth precept.
Uh-huh.
Because for some people, death comes with extreme pain.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the pain management, my understanding is, involves morphine or
yep,
some sort of mind-clouding
yep,
drug. So how does one, I mean, I know that one can request not to have that, but how does one navigate pain?
Right, and that's why I say, like these days, pain management strategies are actually, you know, quite refined, and there's a lot of to and fro between the say the medical providers and nurses and say hospice nurses, and they have a lot of experience in helping people regulate the pain. Also, I mean, there's one, and morphine is, you can zonk yourself out really well with morphine, but you can also take what is suitable for reducing the pain and maintaining a clarity. You know, one of the a really simple thing that, you know, just in terms of experience that they found in hospitals and in hospice, is that you actually give the authority or power of the you can regulate your own pain management, and statistically, the amount of pain killers, pain reliefs, it drops dramatically when it's within your control. Because so much of it is sort of, it's within that fear of, I'm not going to be able to deal with this. And so, yeah, bring it on, because I don't know how it's going to be. But then when you're given the that kind of power or authority to regulate the amount, he goes, yeah, I can deal with this. I mean, you know, obviously, statistically, there'll probably be be some that, but it's in a tiny minority that would over-medicate. Mostly, people under-medicate by a baseline of what was before, what was recommended as a part. So it's just because a lot of it is around, a lot of it's around control, and it's as you're dying. I mean, that's really loss of control. And so, but then that sense of, yeah, you can regulate the amount of pain that you take. But nowadays, I mean, there's a lot of options of different kinds of medications and things that bring relief. And oftentimes you don't even have to get to the point of taking opiates. And because it's yeah, there's just there's a lot of drugs out there, and used in the right way, they're for a medicinal purpose. Yeah. I mean, it's complicated, but for me as a monk, whether it's say taking one's own life or with abortion, taking the life of the fetus, then I can't recommend somebody to do that. If I do, then I cease to be a monk. But it's not, and one of the problems with, and certainly in America, is the absolute black and white that it is treated, and it's not black and white, and it should be moved away from, especially when it's a bunch of old white men, you know, making those laws. Then that should be taken. That shouldn't be a part of it. And it's much more nuanced. And then do you start talking about, you know, there, like especially in America, there's a huge, you know, a sort of right and wrong, black and white. There's no real resources made available for support and options and reproductive health care, all of that. It's a, you know, it's really, if you're not doing that, then you know, you shouldn't be in there dictating. That's my thought. Yeah. Well, yeah, well, I mean, nobody asked the animal. You know. Well, I mean, the thing is yeah, so much of what we, you know, we call this poor animal suffering, you know, more often than not, yeah, again, they don't ask the animal, and it's sort of our own projection. And our own sort of discomfort, and so that being, when you know, to me, it's sort of when you take on the responsibility of having the life of an animal or a child or whatever, then it's your responsibility to really care and provide that care and be ready to acknowledge that. Yeah, okay, part of this is this being is bound up with aging, sickness, and death. And how can I be there for that to be present in that process? Yeah, Bo.
This is a difficult question. years ago, I considered the Buddha as being someone who practiced harm reduction, and but having worked in the field, I've started to have a lot of conflict around when people request paraphernalia to help them use.
Mm-hmm.
The idea, of course, is to keep them alive. But now it's become very complicated because people are still dying. My question is there a violation of right livelihood? And also, if you could speak a little bit about a wisdom in compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you very much for teaching.
I think one of the things that you, primarily, the very first thing that's essential is you reflect on and recollect your own intention. You know, what is my intention in being involved in and being a part of that service? Because it is complicated, and you're going to be seeing it from, you know, depending on the mood of the day, you're going to be seeing it from different perspectives. So that seeing it from what you are acknowledging and trying to work from your own intention and trying to refine your own intention of why you're doing. Because it's, there is a very real effect of reducing infection, reducing the introduction extraneous substances into so it's more safe in terms of the actual drug itself, and so there is that intention of trying to protect people. And then it does allow people to be in a environment where they can receive counseling, be in contact with, alternatives that could be possible. And, you know, the reality is probably the majority are not going to avail themselves, but it's there, and it's that's the intention, is to provide it. You can't force it on people, and the more you restrict it and criminalize it, the more dangerous it is, and the more actually attractive it is in a certain way. You know, so the more normal it becomes, then the more options one has for helping people. And, you know, I think the example of Portugal is a very good example on a actual countrywide level, because you have a small population which is fairly, you know, it's not as spread out as Canada or America, but still, I think it's an interesting experiment that I think has been extremely successful. And, you know, and there's always going to be people addicted, and you know, they are deserving of compassion. So that one isn't just a facility. You know, again, it's sort of recognizing what one's intention is. The intention is to help. And the intention is to facilitate some kind of recovery. But you can't force that. And also, I mean, I think in terms of harm reduction, when you yourself, as a person who is trying to help, you have to learn harm reduction to yourself, because you know it's an environment that can be depressing or frustrating, and you have to learn how to be within that. You have to learn how to pull back and recognize I can't help everybody, and I can't even help myself. You know, but that sense of, you know, I can't help everybody. I can't be doing this all the time. And which is oftentimes the case in social work, where there's a tremendous amount of pressure to just keep pouring yourself into it, and then you end up getting burnt out.
I guess the concern is that sometimes it starts to feel like assisted suicide.
It's true, but it's also, you know, the sense of recognizing that without it, you know, their options are limited, and the amount of harm that happens both to themselves as well as the society around, you can't be responsible for everybody.
I have a question about how much time that people are spending on computers.
Mm-hmm.
And I find a lot of time is wasted, so I think time is valuable and I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I find I do waste time. And I just kind of get from one thing to another. So I just wonder how to make it. I wouldn't say I use computers a lot, but I just notice a society, like you used to get on the bus, you could talk to people, but I don't see that happening so much now. It's sort of sad. I think it's sad that people aren't communicating to one another when, like, at the lunch table, you know, at work. And just before, we would just converse, and now have things in their ears. And you know, I talk to people oftentimes, and they don't hear me.
Yeah, it's a reality, and it's a you know, I think it's just trying to make it more conscious for oneself, and then around with one's immediate circle, and that. Yeah, I mean, I think it's not so much as, it's a conversation for kind of exploring, in the sense of, how does this, what effect does this have? And, you know, what am I, how I'm, this is what I'm seeing and perceiving and feeling. What does this, so it's like an exploration.
Yeah.
Yeah, conversation, and so that sense of opening up as a exploration conversation, and see where it goes. And some people just shut it down pretty quick, or say, "Oh, never thought of that." And then, but yeah, I mean, it's It's not just out in the world. It's at monasteries. No, it's you know, we've got computers. We live in a rural area, so it's one of our main means of communication. But it's you know, we've just set up times that when the computers are on, and then they're not. And you know, so then, because it's a compelling. I mean, that's exactly what they're for. They're there to grab your attention. One of the things that's required of anybody coming to the monastery to stay in terms of begin training is no social media. No personal devices. No personal devices, no social media. And that's kind of baseline. And then there's an office with computers, and then there's times that they're there, that they're on for the, say, the work period, and then I think each monk gets 2 one-hour slots a week to use the computer, have internet access, and then it's and they have to get it done quick because it's going to shut down. So fortunately, you can program. We've got some great computer people, and they can program things to, you know, work in this way. So it's very helpful, because it is, especially when you're say, like a young monk, and you're bored out of your skull, and meditation is the pits. doing something on anything other than going back to your dwelling place and have to be by yourself.
Harm reduction.
So it's, you know, it's you say, even in a monastery, but we can have that conversation pretty clearly, because it's. I mean, there is a certain ethos that we're all committed to, and a certain commitment to a certain standard of discipline and training. So then we can reference that. And that's not so apparent in the world. But yeah, it's a problem for us too. Yes, you've had your hand up a couple times now.
You spoke this morning about monks not have money and don't handle money, but how does a monastery deal with purchasing materials and selling materials or tractors or that kind of
thing? Oh, yeah. I mean, as a monastery, we need to function. So that whatever funds are offered will go to the monastery has funds. It has a bank account. It has credit cards. But then it's also, those are handled by lay stewards who take the responsibility of using the donations of the lay people in a skillful way as possible. So then there's a board of say directors overseeing foundation. So then they're keeping an eye on the finances, and there's a treasurer who's looking after, you know, it's got a good system for, you know, paying attention to the, you know, how the money's used, and the senior monastics, or a few of us, are then involved in the kind of overseeing and in the sense of keeping an eye on as well of the finances, making sure that they're being use skillfully, and so that there is a system involved that the lay people. That's why I say there's this symbiotic relationship of the lay community and the monastic community, and the lay community take on that responsibility to facilitate and then the tracking the use of money really closely, so that's an important piece of administration of a monastery. That the offerings that are made are used in the appropriate way, and then things like vehicles or like at our monastery, and you know every monastery has differences in how they do things, but for our monastery then. Whatever part of the budget that is developed is like with the car, like with the main sort of van of the monastery, and I can't remember how much it is. It might be $500 or a few hundred dollars a month is set aside each month, and then. At 5 years, we switch the van out so that we're basically, rather than buying something new and then paying for it, we'll keep setting the money aside. When we first started the monastery, then there was sort of an ethos of being really frugal and living very simply and not using new things. And so we had a monastery van that somebody had given us, and it kept putting the band-aids on and keep it running and keep going. And then they had a visit of senior monks for an ordination or an offering ceremony of some sort, and then of course the monks leave, take them to the airport. I think Ajahn Sona was on that trip. Anyway, there just before the Golden Gate Bridge, a wheel fell off. Right. Yeah. And then of course then there's the difficulty of while you're on the freeway a wheel falling off, but then there's the difficulty. Oh, I'm supposed to get these monks to the airport, and anyway, the board heard about that, and so that's it for old vehicles. We get a new vehicle. We put money in each month. 5 years, we switch it out. And you've got a safe vehicle. The idea of the monks crashing on the freeway, and that's not really the way that they want to be looking after the Sangha. So, so there's also some back and forth with the symbiotic relationship of the. The monks stating their needs, but then also the lay people sort of saying, oh, I think this would be really appropriate or necessary. Also say, like with building, we don't actually build anything until there's money in the bank. So, and actually right now I've heard, like I've been away for a year, but I got word that the county is getting really antsy with us because they agreed to a sort of overall plan of the monastery, things that we could build and done in phases, but we're so slow that there's a, you guys need to finish this project. And I said, well, you agreed that it was by the face and it's written in there. And we don't, we do things by donation. We don't fundraise and we don't take loans. And that was the deal. We told you that years ago. So, so yeah, that, you know, you definitely need to have money. One of the things we don't use money for is, say, it's like buying food for our normal. Like, we really rely on donations. And then people do make, sometimes they'll make like a financial donation to go towards food. And oftentimes what that ends up being used for is food when we're, as opposed to like daily use and daily needs or a grocery run or whatever, is more for special occasions, so like travel when we send monks to the airport, we got visitors and we can feed them. There is a fund for that, so it's easy, it's very comfortable. So yeah, there's these ways that you deal with the real world. Yeah. Yes.
And I'm glad you did that because I've always had a strong attraction, or nature has had a strong attraction for me, whether birds, any trees, whatever.
Yeah.
And I had a feeling about a disease, a bit of uneasiness. I thought this is a kind of a craving.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be chasing after birds or a tree corn or whatever.
Yeah.
So about 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, they talk at EDC, and there was a question and answer period afterwards. So I took the courage to ask him a question. I said, and he explained, you know, I have a fascination for flowers, I draw them, whatever, try and paint them. Is this craving? Or he said, don't worry about it. Good craving, it was bad craving.
Right.
Convinced me. I thought he might have been saying this just to soothe me, this old man.
Yeah.
I still had a little bit of discomfort, but now I can see that this can be both.
Yeah, it can be both, but you realize that there's a bigger scope. Also, one of the things that I mentioned this morning of the Buddha recognizing that the kind of happiness that he was experiencing was, this is an innocent kind of happiness. It's a blameless kind of happiness, and so you start investigating, sort of saying, "Yeah, that's a blameless happiness." Also, I mean, as an aside, Ajahn Viradamo from Tisarana is a birder, really. Yes. So, usually when he shows up in California, we'll usually try to sort in a side trip somewhere where there's a unique sort of bird life.
Could you please speak about when strong feelings associated with conceit come?
Well, I mean, just a lot of it is if one recognizes the suffering. So that's like from the teaching this morning of really paying attention to that, understanding that fear. Oh, this is suffering, and then really let it sink and seep, and it says, oh, this is suffering. This is really uncomfortable. This is not really And sort of getting understanding it more clearly, then it starts to be more apparent what that feeling of either comparing or trying to prop up a sense of self, then it becomes more clear how that's being fed, what's nourishing it, its nutriment, and then you can release the thing that is nurturing and nourishing that. So some kind of desire or attachment or some kind of preference or some kind of comparison. And so then when you see that more clearly, then the releasing is much more easy, as opposed to, I've got to do something about this, or I should do something about this. And those are things that put you into almost panic mode, and it's much more having that patience to be able to not immediately react, but sort of taking it in and letting it sit there and feel it more clearly, and then it starts to unravel, rather than one having to do something or make it happen. And when once you see it clearly, then it'll cease to have the same compelling quality to it. Because even our suffering, our discomfort, is compelling when it isn't seen clearly.
I'm thinking, oh, there's a discovery. I'm supposed to be making discoveries. And yet I'm spending a lot of time thinking. And I just wonder what the line is between realizing you're caught again.
Pay attention to the feeling of it. How's it feel? Because sometimes our thought process leads us to certain clarity and stability and ease, and oftentimes it doesn't. Oftentimes it's another thought, another projection, another angle, and that's the nature of that thinking process, is to keep building on itself. But so it's not that it's wrong, you have to stop it, but it's sort of like, how do I become skilled in the use of thought and the thought processes, and to pay attention to that. What is it that fosters that sense of ease and clarity and stability? That's what you want to pay attention to, because that's what's helping that aligns itself more clearly with Dhamma. Yeah.
I know in my own practice, improving my skills. That when there's pleasant and unpleasant feelings, can see the greed or the aversion. What I often don't see so clearly is more that neutral feeling state.
Yeah.
I understand that leads to delusion, but I don't quite often see that or understand.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's. That's it. It's performing its function perfectly. But which is one, because it is. It's our that from a reflective mental exploration. Yeah, it's very very difficult. But that's also where it's helpful to. Where, like, mindful, what I found, my own experience, is mindfulness of the body. So that because, really a lot of our time is actually quite neutral. And then being able to tap into that neutral experience of the body. And then see, because the delusion will manifest itself in different ways, either, you know, like usually a restlessness will arise out of that, or, and you can start to feel that in the body, sense of a little bit of, you know, there's this movement that's, it's looking for something, somewhere to land, something else other than this present moment, or a sense of fear, or a sense of anxiety, you know, sense of uncertainty. So then paying attention to the, you know, because you'll feel that in the body, the sense of kind of, there'll be kind of a vibration or a tightening. And you start to recognize, when you recognize that over, and you start to use all of that, that is the functioning of delusion responding to a neutral feeling. So then feeling more and more comfortable with the body and the present moment. Because one of the things of, that's one of the great assets of the body, and say as opposed to the mind, is that at least the body is always in the present moment. And, you know, the mind, yeah, all bets are off. But yeah, body's always in the present moment. So you can always come back. You know, you come back, you're in the present moment. And then tapping into that sense, okay, that's kind of neutral. Because a lot of the experience actually is. But then bringing a sense of comfort or ease or sense of stability around that. And then that starts to turn into a pleasant feeling. Or even if there's something painful, it's got a context to be held in. So that, you know, coming back to the physical posture, the experience of the body, tuning into the different the experience of the body, because we're habituated to going to our thought processes. We're habituated to thinking, conceiving. And the Buddha has asked one time what the what is the world? The world, what is the world? And the Buddha says, that whereby one is a conceiver of the world, a perceiver of the world, that is the world. So that conceiving and perceiving, that in itself is the world. So that and we keep going to it. So then coming back to the kind of fundamental feeling of the body helps to ground us so that it isn't moving to that perceiving and conceiving all the time. It's not that you don't do that or you try to forbid it somehow, but you're starting to recognize that process. Yeah, and that's where the Buddha uses the simile of the two arrows, where you get shot by one arrow and it's painful, but then the reaction to it and the agitation around that. That's another arrow that we tend to self-inflict with, and so we're always going to experience unpleasant, painful feeling, and to be able to acknowledge it as okay, this is a painful feeling, but then extending a certain amount of well, certainly mindfulness, but also that sense of, loving kindness, compassion, where one here we are in the human condition, and we're it's fraught with painful feeling. But also, we have the means whereby we can not complicate it or make it a problem that increase kind of the amplitude of it. Mindful, and that aspect of spoke of this morning of patience, blindly or dumbly putting up with something, but being willing to be present is this quality of patience, or the certain enduring quality of the mind, and that gives us a resilience, so that we're actually learning from a painful experience, and we're cultivating or inclining the heart towards that which is giving it a certain resilience and strength. It's not a totally negative experience, because it's just a painful feeling, and that's all painful feelings do. But then when we respond to it with skillfulness and awareness, then we actually develop a certain strength. And it's important to, again, I've said it a few times, it isn't that there is an inherent virtuous quality to pain and suffering, but it's also what we learn from it is so important.
I live with my 96-year-old mother, and I'm back in the family home with her, and her body is over here. Her mind is quite good, and the body is aging, the pain in the both legs, left hip, right knee, and just seeing her work with the pain, and the stubborn will to carry on, like do a roast beef last night, because we have company. But then what I find in myself, I've had, harsh voice, harsh tones, and, the rising of impatience and things like that. And then, but we have our fights, but we get through them very quickly. But I'm also... to go to another level to develop more patience.
Mm-hmm.
Can you comment on that?
Delighting in the opportunity that your mother's still around, and she has most of her faculties, and so that's it's a blessing, but also to recognize that there's always going to be some dynamic there where, like, you're always going to be her daughter.
I'm trying to win in the kitchen, but
forget it. Forget it. Like my mom's 96, and there's just some things you have to give up on. So even as a monk and a sort of a revered teacher, and that doesn't cut it. So I mean, there is a certain willingness to not be ready to put stuff down really quickly. And then to dwell on the fact that, at 96, there's not a whole lot of time left, and to to not waste it in negativity or and it doesn't mean you're not going to feel it or get caught up sometimes, but you know cut yourself some slack and also recognize the fact that you've actually made the effort and the commitment to come back and help look after your mom. So that's a huge thing. And that functioning from a place of gratitude is a really important piece of the puzzle. And then you've got a context for letting go, because it isn't just I'm going to be patient. that doesn't work, because that's coming from a place of idealism of what you think you should be. But lifting up a quality of gratitude, then the negativity or impatience ends up being dissolved in that inclination to what is wholesome and skillful. You know, and then I said, and yeah, cut yourself some slack when you lose it.
Only know time is short, and so
yeah.
These things don't last very long.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've got Wednesday I'll be with my mom. So see, even monks have mothers.
Manitoba.
Yeah, I made the effort to arrange for to meet my mom. She's living in Alberta. All my siblings ended up moving out there. But that's where she grew up. That's where my dad grew up and born and raised there, so Winnipeg. So take her there or meet her there and then have time to set up some meetings with relatives and whatnot. So.
Even reading sort of scripturally oriented material can be used as escape or as a way to check out or something easier than sitting and meditating.
Yeah.
And I was wondering about the precept on entertainment and meditation and adornment.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give some advice on how to interpret that in practical terms to know when one is entertaining or when one is checking out as opposed to reading or other things for
sake? Yeah, I mean I think one of the things is again not to get so locked into kind of an idealistic standard of what you think, because as human beings then, we do seek some kind of, say entertainment, but in the sense of, what as an innocent directing of attention that doesn't kind of ripple through the mind over time, and then recognizing when the reality is I'm, I'm just looking to relax somehow, so that a lot of it's around its innocence, but then it's also okay. What if it's too much? How do you measure that? I mean, it's more around you have to be looking back on one's own experience because we can do the same thing with conversation and social interaction. And of course, the Buddha said to have good friends and You know, can we do that? We can distract ourselves with all of our good friends. You know, so, I mean, it's not it's not black and white. But a lot of it is being willing to pay attention to what is when is it becoming a distraction? When is it leading to agitation? When is it helping to facilitate a sense of kind of just relaxing and settling? When is it helping to kind of inspire one to put forth effort in practice? So kind of sometimes our reading or because these days media is so diverse. You can go down that rabbit hole of YouTube, and completely disappear for hours and days. But you can also Ajahn Sona has got great stuff on, in terms of both the video and audio Dhamma talks, and Bhaiyagiri it takes hours, I think, usually, and the Dhamma talks are up on YouTube and on the website. So much is available, which in former times, access to Dhamma was quite difficult. Access to teachers, now you can access. So you can distract yourself with that as well, listening to all this good Dhamma. So, it's not black and white, and it's just really paying attention to, well, what is it that really helps to support. And then, different people have different temperaments. From time to time, I enjoy reading good fiction. Is it a defilement? Yeah, maybe, but, it's from time to time. It's kind of relaxed. Other people, it might be a real distraction. So you have to be willing to investigate that. But it's recognizing the effect that it has, and then also what is it that helps to nurture the qualities that settle and bring clarity to the mind. Hey, it looks like we're running out of questions. Any last frantic hand raising? Okay, we can just have a quick sit, and then we'll transition to a walking period, and then gather together for a last sit together for the afternoon.